This is an ABC podcast.
This is ABC Australia Wide on ABC Radio.
We're very frustrated because it's the role of the police to catch the crooks, not taxi them all over the countryside.
New South Wales country cops say they're spending too much time transporting prisoners to and from court and keeping the art of Punch and Judy alive in South Australia.
Puppeteering is a dying art, and unless there's somebody that takes an interest within the next 5-10 years, nobody will know what a puppet really was.
I'm Sinead Mangan, and this is Australia Wide. Australians rank amongst the healthiest people in the world, but the findings of the CSIRO Future of Health report says behind that fact lies a few alarming figures, particularly when it comes to the health of people in regional and rural areas, where people have lower life expectancy, poorer mental health outcomes and higher rates of disease and injury. Rob Grenfell is the CSIRO's Director of Health and Biosecurity, and he joins me now. Now, Rob, as a person who spent a large amount of your career in the bush as a GP, how does the healthcare in the country stack up if you look at elsewhere?
Look, Australia has one of the best healthcare systems in the world, and that's measured on the access to it and the affordability, but also the clinical outcomes. However, we still have a system that has disparities of care across it, and rural Australians, unfortunately, still fare less in sense of outcomes compared to urban equivalents. And that also is even further increased if you happen to be an Indigenous rural Australian as well. So if we're to move towards a system of greater improvement, we have to continue to focus on the disparities of care, or at least the inequity that exists in our healthcare system.
In a practical sense, how could technology help people in the bush? Can you give me examples of where it might play into healthcare?
Well, look, again, where Australia comes from, since 1920, we've been using telemedicine types of services since John Flynn started using radio for the flying doctor service. We've now taken that and lead the world in a lot of the science of particularly telemedicine or telehealth services. And rural Australia is benefiting from a lot of those. From here at CSIRO, we've done pilots on looking at eye screening, the management of chronic diseases from a distance, but also augmented locally. But these, again, are still at the trial phase. So a number of these need to be implemented into usual care. And that, again, is a very challenging and tortuous path, which I could go through if you like, but it's also a long story.
Are there any places that are particularly looking at that, you know, like regional towns that are kind of test cases for the CSIRO for that technology?
Look, if I look at our remote eye work, we did that across the Torres Strait Islands and the Northern Kimberley, and was very effective in looking at automatic eye screening for diabetes disease. But it's all well and good to find disease, but the second part is, what do I do with it when we do? So you still have that challenge of, I have to get that, if that person has eye disease that needs treatment, I still have to have a system that allows them to get to the care they need, the physical care they need. So that's the implementation challenge. If we look at the work that's been coming out of both rural Queensland and also West Australia, these are really world-leading with regards to how they're not only doing video conferencing, but they're also doing remote monitoring for people with diseases and the management and optimisation. So there are many pockets of where there's excellence occurring in Australia. Again, standardising this over the whole healthcare system is the challenge that we face.
Do you ever see a time in the future where technology could bridge that gap that we see in Australia between rural healthcare and urban healthcare?
You know, what's fascinating is that I often thought as a rural doc that I'd never see the difference levelled off. And Phil Titterman and others in rural South Australia have managed to do that with cardiovascular care into the southeast, where they actually through a systematic reform for cardiovascular care, going, this is towns like Keith and Narracourt, Bordertown, they managed to, in fact, actually equalise the clinical care outcomes from the rural South Australians compared to the Adelaide South Australians. Now, if we could replicate that type of systematic reform across the rest of Australia, we would, in fact, actually level off the differential between rural and urban Australians. But that gives you hope that we can do this. So that involves a whole range of technological applications, so the idea, and but also staff changes. So allowing the staff that are on the site to know that they have an expert cardiologist a fingertip away so that they can act on it.
So what would it take in terms of from government, from community and from the medical sector to replicate what's going on there in the southeast of South Australia?
Yeah, look, implementation science is the way of actually getting technology to work. And traditionally it takes around about 15 years for evidence-based care to get into usual clinical practice. Now that may sound quite alarming to you, to the average Australian, but there are reasons for this. First and foremost is that if you have a new therapy, it has to be safe and it has to have high quality and it also has to have what we call clinical utility. That is, it's as good as or better than usual care. So it's all well and good to have distance care coming into your rural town, but if it's not as good as or equivalent to usual care, you have to question why would we be doing this. The other question for the payers, and in most cases this is the government, whether state or federal, is it has to have cost efficiency and to allow them to actually do this. The other challenges that come through here are the workforce and the workforce readiness to adopt the new technology. And this, in fact, is a significant barrier to the implementation of new technology by changing the way that people do their work. And that's not easy. And it requires considerable efforts to actually do that. I'd like people to think about, you know, when you got your new smartphone, how long did it take you to learn how to use it and learn how to use the features? Did you like it? Did you want to go back to the old phone? Or for that matter, the way we've changed the way we even use telephones altogether. That's sort of a personalised example of how hard it is to get people to change the way they use technology.
Rob Grenfell, the CSIRO's Director of Health and Biosecurity. Thanks for talking to Australia Wide.
My pleasure.
You're listening to ABC Australia Wide.
Country cops in New South Wales say police are spending too much time transporting prisoners to and from court, a responsibility usually carried out by corrective services. They say frontline police services in regional New South Wales are being compromised. Carla Mascarenhas reports.
We're very frustrated because it's the role of the police to catch the crooks, not taxi them all over the countryside.
Coffs Harbour-based Inspector Brett Henderson-Smith from the New South Wales Police Association says prisoner transportation is affecting their ability to tackle the ICE epidemic gripping regional New South Wales as they roster more police during the week instead of at crime peak times such as at night or during the weekend.
The results are the police aren't available there to keep the public safe. They're diverted from their core duties.
Inspector Henderson-Smith says there have been cases in Foster, Maxwell and Gunnedah where there have been no police in the town because they're on the road transporting prisoners. In the New South Wales Central West, over the last two financial years, police have transferred 414 prisoners, travelling over 100,000 kilometres.
Now that equates to over 230 12-hour shifts that our police were not on the road protecting the community and available for calls for service.
Officer in charge at Parkes Police Station, Inspector Dave Cooper, says the long distances police have to travel in regional areas between correction facilities and court make the situation particularly dire.
The burden of prisoner escorts in the Parkes area is such that we have, you know, compared to our friends in the metropolitan areas, we have low number prisoner numbers, but we travel great distances. What that equates to is many, many hours off the road for our police.
The New South Wales government declined an interview with the ABC, but in a statement said they were working with relevant agencies to explore new options. Those options include trialling new arrangements in a number of locations, increasing the use of audio-visual links, and changes to how accused persons requiring a mental health assessment are transferred from the courts.
Carla Mascarenhas with that report.
All around the country, you're on ABC Australia Wide.
Like, say the swimming carnival, I can tell them about how, like, the races are, and as well, there's a big carnival, like, where we show our house colours.
You've never done that before?
No, not really.
Australia has recorded the lowest number of drowning deaths ever this year, according to the Royal Life Saving Society. 249 people died in Australian waters last year, a quarter of those in rivers and creeks and streams. Lauren Nemo is a spokesperson for the Society and she joins me now. Now, Lauren, the report breaks down the number of deaths into pools, coast and rivers and creeks. Are there areas where you've seen particular improvements?
We have seen particular improvements at a national level at a number of aquatic locations, particularly home swimming pools and those locations in and around the home, which is really pleasing. However, the report does highlight that a quarter of drowning deaths, like you mentioned, occurred at locations that were inland, so rivers, creeks and streams, where perhaps people aren't so familiar or aware of the risks that exist. So it certainly is an important area for drowning prevention over the coming summer.
Do you think the reason that you've seen improvements around pools is because of the big publicity push about looking after toddlers around pools and looking after children around pools?
There's certainly been a big commitment from Royal Life Saving and other drowning prevention organisations across Australia to promote the importance of swimming pool safety, particularly around having compliant barriers around home pools to provide that extra layer of protection to prevent children from accessing those areas. So it is really pleasing to see a decrease in not only home pool drowning deaths, but also in toddlers at a national level, which means that the community are really starting to pick up on some of these messages and create safer environments for kids around water.
You said a quarter of those who died in Australian waters died in rivers and creeks. How has the Respect the River campaign, I think that was launched 3 years ago, what difference has that made?
The Respect the River campaign has now been running for a number of years throughout Australia, and it was really based on a 10-year analysis that showed that the Murray, Brisbane and Yarra rivers in particular were targeted black spots for river drowning. And the program has been very successful in reducing the amount of people that are drowning in our rivers, despite the fact that it still is the leading cause for drowning at a national level. We are continuing to see decreases in the proportion of deaths happening at these locations, and there's some great local level programs that are running throughout states in Australia that are really promoting those strong messages around how being able to identify the risks at rivers and how to stay safe and keep others safe when they're participating around those locations.
What about non-fatal drownings, Lauren? In what areas are they most likely to happen?
Often when people think about drowning in the community, their first reference is to think that someone's died from drowning. But what is certainly highlighted in this report is that 551 people were hospitalised following a non-fatal drowning incident across Australia, which is a significant number of people that are affected and often do have long-term health outcomes as the result of brain injury and spinal cord injury. These incidents happen at a range of locations. We do typically see toddlers and young children, the highest rate of presentations to hospital following a non-fatal drowning incident. So again, it is really important that we're getting these messages through to all members of the community about how important drowning prevention is.
How often is alcohol involved in drowning?
Alcohol is a big contributing factor in a number of drowning incidents, particularly when we talk about males and in particular young males. Too often we see men consuming alcohol while participating in or around aquatic environments, and we know that alcohol does play a significant role in reducing inhibitions, reducing reaction speeds, coordination, and increasing the likelihood that people are going to participate in risky behaviours. So it's a very important message for us to provide to the community that avoiding alcohol around water is a very important strategy to reduce drowning.
Lauren Nemo from the Royal Life Saving Society, thank you.
Thanks so much for having me.
This is ABC Australia Wide.
And you're with me, Sinead Mangan. Meanwhile, in a separate study, Dr. Mel Taylor of the Bushfire Natural Hazard CRC found Australians don't treat floodwater with enough caution.
I guess the general perception is that water just doesn't pose quite the same degree of risk. People are familiar with water. They swim, you know, they interact with it regularly. It doesn't typically harm you in those ways. So I think it, as a threat in itself, as a hazard in itself, it doesn't tend to create such a fear as it should do, because more people die in floods than do in bushfires in Australia. So it is really a serious hazard.
So that's quite remarkable that more people die in floodwaters than they do in bushfires. Is it a certain segment of the community that take that gamble?
It's across the whole community. And again, it just depends on the types of behaviours that relate to those deaths. So, you know, you get younger people typically playing in floodwaters and, you know, getting caught out there. And you get older people who are drivers, generally driving through floodwater, which tends to be the main cause of human fatalities in floods.
So in your work, how do you change that messaging that people see it? The same way as they see as a bushfire, I have to change my response to this situation because this is going on right here, right now.
Well, what we're doing at the moment, our research is looking to identify, I guess, a number of different factors about those behaviours, and then look and see how we might influence the communication that goes on around, you know, warning the public and trying to, I guess, engage in what those hazards are. I think at the moment we're really trying to, I guess, work towards raising awareness of the hazards there, but also trying to identify, you know, what people already know and understand about the risk and what it is that can be pointed out or discussed to try and reduce, you know, those the behaviours that could actually be really hazardous to people and could cause injuries and deaths.
So what should people look out for? If you're up the Gibb River Road and you come across floodwater, what should you do? Yeah.
Well, again, it depends obviously on the conditions. I mean, if you listen to the formal warning, always the best advice is to turn around and find alternative routes. So that's got to be the starting point. And if for some reason that's not possible, you know, you really need to be looking out for a whole range of different environmental sort of factors. I'm not necessarily an expert in the physical environment, but at the same time, you know, I know that obviously, you know, the depth of the floodwater, the flow of the floodwater, you know, if it's moving, the water's moving, it takes a lot less water to actually, you know, knock you into the river if it's a river or deeper water, and to wash you and your car away. Alongside that, you know, other factors, you may be familiar with the road, and this is often what we find, that people have got experience of driving that road, you know, regularly, and they know what it's like. They know how deep the water is likely to be. But of course, even in those situations in floodwater, you can't see the road surface, and that's where the issues come as well, that, you know, that can be eroded, washed away, there can be large potholes, and so you can go across, you know, the water, you know, the road's way that you know, but it can be a really different environment to what you're used to.
That was Dr. Mel Taylor of the Bushfire Natural Hazards CRC.
We are one.
I've been training water for 40 years. Just get up and go out, put the jug on and then put the radio on. Every day I listen to the Country Hour at 12 o'clock. Every place you go to, the ABC's on. Got decent news and you know what's going on. People have been relying on that out in the farms all their life. So you can't take that away. It'd be like trying to take the flying doctor away. I'm Cockatoo Collins and that's my story.
Share your stories at abc.net.au/yours.
The discovery of a fur seal in Western Australia's warm Kimberley region has left scientists and rangers baffled. Research scientist Holly Rodino says it's quite unusual to see a seal as far north as Broome.
Well, we think it's a fur seal. There's a couple of species that you find here in Western Australia. The first is the New Zealand fur seal, and the name's a bit misleading because it's actually within its normal range to be here in Western Australia, but obviously not as far north as Broome. So we have colonies down off Perth and off the southwest, so it's still like a long way out of its range. The other species that it could possibly be is a subantarctic fur seal. So in recent years, we've had more and more sightings of these guys, but usually they're in poor condition, so they kind of haul out and they're sick and emaciated and starving. This was not the case for this seal that was seen in Broome. It was looked really healthy and in good condition. So perhaps it's just a vagrant, just exploring a bit further north and just outside its range.
The vagrant fur seal up in the Kimberley, and that was research scientist Holly Rodino, and she was speaking to Molly Hunt. The art of puppetry is slowly becoming extinct, but one couple in Wilmington in South Australia are trying to keep it alive. Shannon Corvo reports.
From Sesame Street to the cult classic E.T.
E.T. Home phone.
Puppets have been a favourite among kids and adults alike since their first inception over 3,000 years ago. But for 72-year-old Mr. Brian Whitehead, the co-owner of Sanssouci Puppet Museum and Gallery at Wilmington, located in the Flinders Ranges, the inanimate and sometimes downright creepy unconscious beings mean much more.
I was very ill for a long time and in hospital, and I was very lucky because there was only one other person in the ward with me. And one day he said, "Brian, get your wheelchair." I thought we were going to the pub, but no, we went down four floors into another ward, and he pulled a box from out under the bed and said, "We're going to do puppet shows."
Every day for about 3 months, the two performed puppet shows in the hospital.
Broken legs, broken arms, cancer, you name it, they had it. They weren't interested in me. All they were interested in was the puppets.
After Brian was discharged, life was very different. He couldn't work, so he decided to embark on a world cruise. He bought puppets from here and there, but it wasn't until he returned home that his collection grew.
When I came home, a friend picked me up and told me there was a box in my shed. I went out to the shed 3 months later, opened it. There was 25 puppets in there.
Jeff had passed away, the one that taught Brian about puppetry and taught him to use the puppets, and had left Brian the puppets on the proviso that he would use them.
That's exactly what Brian did. He performed shows in schools, hospitals, and fairs. Then, when Brian got sick again, he and his partner Rosemary bought a bank in Wilmington and turned it into the Sanssouci Puppet Museum and Gallery. Sanssouci comes from Haiti, and it means no worries.
You had met me in the meantime, yes. And I got out the big whip.
They opened the museum at the end of October in 2007. What started out as a collection of 200 puppets easily became over 1,000.
When everybody heard about the bird.
The museum houses marionettes, such as that crazy singing red bird with 2 feet, hand puppets including the original Punch and Judy collection, old Warner Brothers characters and ventriloquist dummies. Outside the museum is a gallery filled with Brian's old chess sets and handmade wind chimes, as well as Rosemary's dream catchers and hand-painted eggs. The couple also sell little bush baby and echidna puppets they've made themselves.
Brian designed them, I make them. I sit out there with my machine, like a spider in a web, to catch the people.
The Sanssouci Puppet Museum and Gallery is one of the last remaining puppet museums in Australia.
Puppeteering is a dying art, and unless there's somebody that takes an interest within the next 5-10 years, nobody will know what a puppet really was.
But there's no doubt Brian and Rosemary will continue to make kids and adults smile for years to come.
ABC reporter Shannon Corvo speaking to Brian and Rosemary Whitehead, the owners of one of Australia's last remaining puppet museums. And Trixie Oldfield joins me now in the studio with what else is making news, Trix.
Yes, needles have been found in 2 brands of strawberries across 3 states. The Chief Health Officer in Queensland has asked people in Queensland, New South Wales and Victoria to throw out berry obsession or berry-licious strawberries that they've bought in the past week. They've also been taken off the shelves in those 3 states. This is after needles were found in 3 punnets of strawberries, 1 in Queensland and 2 in Victoria. The needles have been grown on a farm in southeast Queensland, and one person has swallowed half a sewing needle. The ABC has reported a Facebook user posted about their friend biting through a strawberry and swallowing half the needle and being at emergency with severe abdominal pain. They checked the other strawberries in the punnet and found another sewing needle lodged inside one of the strawberries. Queensland police are investigating. They believe the contamination was deliberate.
That is a pretty grim story. Thanks very much, Trixie Oldfield.
Thank you, Sinead.
And if you want to find out more about any of Australia-wide's stories, do go to our website. You can also get in touch with me and Trixie there. Don't forget, we are podcast as well, and you can find us on the ABC Listen app or wherever you find your favourite podcasts. I'm Sinead Mangan. I hope you have a lovely evening. Cheerio.